Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How dangerous is the world we live in? From our vantage point in the U.S., many of the greatest tragedies taking place on the planet today seem distant and shamefully easy to ignore. But my guest today is convinced that if the world's most prosperous nations would accept a greater role in international relief efforts, we might give birth to the generation that could end suffering brought on by violence, poverty, and natural disaster. Jan Egeland served as United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator from 2003 through 2006. Before that, he was the Secretary General's Special Envoy for Colombia. As State Secretary of the Norwegian Ministry for Foreign Affairs, he initiated the Norwegian Channel between Israel and the PLO that yielded the 1993 Oslo Accord. He is currently serving as Director General of the Norwegian Foreign Affairs Institute, and this week he publishes a new book called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. At the invitation of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, Egeland will be in town for an address Wednesday, and we are very happy to have him with us for the hour to talk about his ideas. Jan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. Good of you to have me.
What is the responsibility to protect?
The responsibility to protect is what was solemnly sworn by world leaders from my own country, Norway, to your president of the United States and 190 other governments in the UN building in 2005 at the summit meeting, where they said, if a government is not protecting their own people against genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing, and indeed perhaps even helps it or condones it or orchestrates all of this, we will, as the United Nations, stop it, even perhaps with the use of force. And this responsibility to protect is one of the most important agreements, I think, in recent times, and it is, unfortunately, not upheld.
Yeah, when you talk about the responsibility to protect, I'm wondering how much you think we should try to change the political and social cultures of struggling countries if their values and practices strike us as immoral or unethical?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a question of, you know, whether our values and their values clash. It's basically our common global human rights that are violated. It's basically, in this case, children being killed and maimed, women being massively raped, like it's happening in Darfur, in eastern Congo, civilians being killed every day now in Gaza and in Israel. These are civilians that are not being protected. What I saw as the humanitarian coordinator for global emergency relief was that we became more and more effective, actually, in reaching out to help peoples after the tsunami, after the earthquakes. We were even able to reach out with hundreds of thousands of tons of food from America in Darfur, but we were not protecting them. And that's what I'm describing in this book, A Billion Lives, the frustration of being at times a humanitarian alibi for lack of political and security action.
Yeah, you've made the point that we are pretty good at providing emergency relief with temporary shelter and food aid and blankets. What else do traumatized populations need to protect their lives and the value of their lives?
Well, of course, what they need is really the rule of law. I should start now by telling good people in Dallas and elsewhere that it is not true that the world is getting worse. The world is getting better. On my watch in the United Nations, the UN helped bring peace to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, Southern Sudan, Burundi, to Nepal, to East Timor, to the Kosovo, to large parts of the Congo. There is 50% more peace and less war now than when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. However, it is, as you say in your question, I mean, it's not enough to put a band-aid on the wound by giving people emergency rations and a tent if they are threatened by militias who specialized in killing innocent women and children, as still happens in the remaining wars of our time and age.
What are the challenges, Jan, to raising money for aid to places that don't experience what you call the CNN effect, which is that sort of overwhelming attention to a crisis that's come on very suddenly?
There was one of the frustrations of my time as emergency relief coordinator, that every year we scientifically did needs assessments in the field, as we said. I mean, in the 2030 disaster and war-stricken regions of the world, we then came up with exactly how much was needed of food, of emergency relief items, of health, of sanitation, of vaccination, of emergency education. And then we asked the world for, on average, it was between $3 and $5 billion for this. Sounds as a lot of money, but it's, I mean, Europeans eat ice cream for many times that amount. Americans spend much more, you know, per month on their pets. So it wouldn't we should expect that a rich world could foot that bill. If we didn't. Every year we came up with half, which made our poor relief workers in the field have to choose. Should we feed these or should we feed those? Should we continue with vaccination or should we do emergency education? And what we need is predictability, and that's why it's so important that nations fulfill the goal of the United Nations to at least give 0.7% of the gross national income to predictable international assistance. The average today is 0.2%.
So that amount of spending is something that actually a lot of the member states to the UN have actually agreed to, but very few have fulfilled. Is that correct?
Exactly. I mean, this was agreed time and again on international meetings, 0.7 goal. I think it dates back to the 1970s. And my own country, Norway, came to that level, you know, a generation ago, when we were pretty, when we were not very rich. I mean, my family didn't have a car even, but we fulfilled the goal. The average of the rich countries, as I say today, which are, you know, infinitely richer than they were in the 1970s, are still giving this lackluster 0.18%. And I never read in the Bible or in any other holy scriptures, keep 99.8% to yourself and give 0.2% to the biggest moral cause of our time, which is to root out global hunger, global misery, epidemic disease, and serious violations against women and children.
And just to clarify, would that spending be necessarily funneled through the UN, or would that include all international spending that also went from So it doesn't just have to go to the UN. It can be whatever a country chooses to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, most of it would go through either bilateral channels like US Aid, which is doing a very good job from the United States, or through non-governmental organizations like CARE, Oxfam, World Vision, Save the Children Alliance, American Red Cross, all of those good non-governmental organizations. All that adds up. I mean, all that government money have many, many channels, but it adds up only to 0.12 or for the better countries, 0.3%. There are, I think, three nations in the world trying to do the 1% goal, and that is Sweden, Norway, and the Netherlands.
You famously criticized the world's wealthy nations for their paltry aid pledges in the first few days following the tsunami in 2004. There was some tremendous backlash here in the U.S. and other parts of Europe. Can you talk for a minute about what you were trying to communicate when you made that statement? And you used a word, stingy, that really just set people off.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I write about it in some details in this book, A Billion Lives, because it was the most surreal thing that happened. We all woke up on the second day of Christmas to the devastating tsunami. It was the worst natural disaster for a long time, and it happened, you know, in the period of year where there are not many much news. People were sitting at home. Everybody were concerned with this. I, as the Global Emergency Relief Coordinator, got into gear. I was woken up, 6 a.m. by the news. We went into work, and the next day we could present an action plan for relief. And all eyes were watching. I remember vividly in the UN briefing room, there had never been as many television channels. I think CNN and BBC and others were broadcasting live. At the end of this very long press conference, I get a question which is not related to emergency relief in the tsunami, which I had detailed. It was related to, could this have been prevented in any way? And in the same question, and are you afraid that money may now go from Africa to tsunami relief? So I said, yes, this could have been prevented. There could have been an early warning system. If there had been investment in development, or prevention of disasters in the Indian Ocean, and yes, I am afraid that it will take attention away from the Congo and Sudan and elsewhere, and money will go to the tsunami, because we are all giving so little, really, of every dollar or every pound or every krona. And then I famously said, Christmas should remind us how rich we have become. Providing 0.14% is stingy, really. So I didn't refer to any country in particular. I was perhaps thinking more of the oil-rich Gulf countries than any other type of nations, or Europeans, or everybody was in my mind. And I was certainly not thinking of the tsunami relief, which I knew would be generous. We always get a lot of money for that kind of dramatic, televised natural disasters.
And yet, it would appear that based on the attention that was placed, at least from the U.S., onto the government's pledge of aid, which was initially $15 million and then increased greatly, that your words certainly hit home. Do you regret them, given that they did have a great deal of impact?
No, I'm now very, very pleased that it set in motion that national debate from the United States to the oil-rich countries to many of the stingy European countries. I think it's frankly abhorrent that some countries basically that are drowning in luxury are only giving a fraction of a percentage in international assistance.
Jan Egeland is my guest. He's former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. He'll be in town Wednesday to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. His new book is called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. After the break, you can join our conversation. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. We will speak in just a moment about how to start engaging emerging superpowers like China and India in international relief efforts.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jan Egeland, former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. He joins us from the studios of WRTI in Philadelphia. And his new book is called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. You can join us today by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Jan, how do we start to engage emerging superpowers like China and like India, which have in the past been able to certainly use it as a defense the fact that they were developing countries themselves?
And they are not anymore developing countries. I mean, some parts of them are, but what I saw in Africa is that China and India are the biggest investors. China is buying large parts of the natural resources of many African countries. It's the biggest investor in Sudan. So we have to do two things. One is to recognize them as superpowers in a multipolar world. It's not anymore only the United States. China is a huge force. But we need then, recognizing their importance, also to hold them accountable. And in Darfur, certainly China should have done much more, much earlier, to avoid this small conflict from becoming a full-blown catastrophe of ethnic cleansing against defenseless civilians, supported and orchestrated by the government of Sudan. India, this huge investor in Sudan, should have been held accountable. Pakistan, Malaysia, which are so important, and the Arab countries that have a cultural and political influence should have been held accountable, and not only the Western countries.
So if there's money to invest economically, there is money to invest in providing relief.
They have, they have money to invest now in our relief and to spend on that, but they also have political leverage. So exactly what you alluded to in your in your first question, I mean, I don't think they can play superpower one day being the biggest investor in Africa, and the next day say, no, we're just a poor developing country and a bystander and observer of what is happening in this part of the world. It has to be the European Union, the United States, that has to solve the problems there. No, I think they can be held accountable.
Would it be sufficient for them to use their political leverage in these other places where they are investing economically right now and turn any kind of economic aid back around to help exclusively the poorest people in their own countries?
Well, you mean in their own country being China and
China
India?
China and India, yes.
No, I mean, they can, of course, what is already happening, that's part of the good news. The development in India and in China is a big part for the reason that the world is having so many people getting out of poverty and getting this huge global middle class. There is, for the first time ever, less than 1 billion people who survive on less than $1 a day. However, the countries that are now emerging economic superpowers have to, number one, become important donors. They did become donors in the tsunami, but then we didn't see them in the next appeal for Africa. They have to help us invest in Africa. Secondly, they have to use their political leverage on the countries, whether that would be Zimbabwe and Mugabe or Bashir, the president of Sudan. And thirdly, help, as India already is doing, in providing peacekeepers for the UN, and even now also China providing peacekeepers for the UN force, which has been so miserably slow in reaching Darfur.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jan Egeland, former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. He'll be in town Wednesday to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. His book is called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. Let's speak to David in Fort Worth. Hi, David. Hi, David. Are you with us? Okay, we'll move on to Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for letting me be part of this conversation.
Sure.
This is very timely for me. I just attended a forum on the from a UN speaker on the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW for short, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly in December of 79. And it's a treaty that we have signed, but we haven't, our Congress and government hasn't ratified it. And she suggested the reason it hasn't been ratified and that we don't pay our portion of the UN budget is because we're afraid of losing sovereignty. And I just wanted to know if he was familiar with the CEDAW and what he thought about, you know, our leaders not really making this up front and prime. I mean, our leaders are kind of telling us the message that we don't think the UN is worth our what we're supposed to. We're supposed to contribute a quarter of the UN budget, and we are not doing that. And I think that's one reason some people, you know, the CNN effect, we're ready to help for that, but we're not ready to help with the other things that our administration and our government leaders don't seem to want to enforce.
Thanks for your call.
I'll drop you there.
Thanks, Nancy.
Well, I think Nancy is onto something very important. Number one, the work for women through the UN and through other international organizations is very important. The abuse of women, the discrimination of women is horrific in many places. It's among the things that haunts me still at night to see and to meet the thousands of abused women in Eastern Congo in a war where rape is rampant. It's a part of the strategy of the militias. In Darfur, some of the women that were raped were then threatened to be put to trial by the government because they had for what is called promiscuity. It is horrific what's happening. The UN is trying to spearhead a lot of initiative for women, including this convention. And yes, I think it's important for the people of this country to tell Congress that we do not want the Senate to avoid ratifying conventions that are pro-women, pro-human rights, pro-international cooperation, pro-standards, where there is bad governance. We're in favor of those international initiatives, and they're wholly in harmony with American ideals. But it's true, yes, America is among those who are the slowest and latest to ratify international agreements, and that goes even for the climate change agreement, the one against climate change, which is, you know, so important for saving the environment of the planet.
Can you speak for a moment about the preparations that the UN is making for the expected devastation that will come as climate change continues to grow worse?
But the whole process now in the UN is to go from one conference to the other up until at the end of year, everybody meeting in Copenhagen next to my country, Norway, the capital of Denmark, for a new agreement that will take over where the old Kyoto Agreement of Japan left. And the new agreement will be basically one where the peoples of the world do two things. One is mitigation of climate change, meaning we have to dump far less garbage out in the atmosphere, CO2. The rich countries have to come dramatically down, and the emerging, the developing powers, China, India, have to stop growing in what they are emitting. Secondly, we have to give a lot more to adaptation in the Sahel belt, in the hurricane belts of this world, where natural disasters have grown threefold when it's now a question of life and death, that the climate is changing and you have much more extreme weather, more drought where it's already dry, more floods where it's already wet, etc.
Before you even get into the question of holding signing countries accountable for the promises that they've made, there's the question of how you monitor how well they're following what they've promised to do. How is that undertaken by the UN?
Well, we're doing a lot of monitoring now. I think the standard setting of the UN and also the observer function of this global body of countries from north, south, east and west is very, very important. So, for example, we're doing mortality surveys, nutritional surveys, surveys, educational surveys, the situation of women, gender-based surveys. All of these things lead up to us being able to provide social x-rays, if you like, of countries. There are indexes also on human quality indexes, etc., where you see some European countries and North America very, very much on top. And you see countries like Niger or Sierra Leone, etc., in Africa falling dramatically below, with life expectancy, which is nothing near what we can expect, and still child mortality rates, which are horrific. And it shouldn't be like that. So, I mean, what we do is we find out what the situation is, and then we come with a recipe for changing it. And here's my whole point in my book, A Billion Lives. It doesn't cost that much to end world hunger, as we know it. It doesn't cost that much to end epidemic disease as we know it until now. It would be enough if the world gives these 0.7%, which we agreed would be the standard for the developing the industrialized countries a generation ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jan Egeland, former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. His book is called A Billion Lives. You stepped into your final position at the UN following the tragic death of Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was killed in a bombing attack on UN offices in Baghdad in 2003. What sort of thought did you give to your own safety in the time that happened and as you were preparing to undertake the same position?
Indeed, it was such a dramatic start. I landed on Newark Airport in close to New York to take up my new post on the 19th of August 2003. And the breaking news on the television screens was UN bombed in Baghdad, 22 colleagues dead. And before I could even reach passport control, my friend and one of my predecessors, Sergio Vieira de Mello, was pronounced dead. Mission to the field was, at the request of Secretary General Kofi Annan, to Baghdad to explore whether we could at all continue to do work. I was among those who argued fiercely for us staying in Baghdad, but we had several new bombs against the UN, against the Red Cross, and it was just impossible for unarmed humanitarian workers, international workers, to stay behind. It was one of my bitterest moments. Personally, I've been crossing front lines and been in war zones since I came as a 19-year-old from Norway the first time to Colombia, war-torn Colombia in Latin America. And by and large, I have, as an international, envoy, been very well protected. Those who are, killed, maimed, abused, raped, are the local people. That's why it's so important that we are there as internationals to provide some protection, provide some security, and also provide witnesses to what is happening.
Well, and we should say Secretary General Annan was one of those who agreed with you that if at all possible, UN forces should stay in Baghdad. But you also have to make a lot of decisions and put a lot of things into account when you're deciding whether or not you'll ask other UN employees to stay in harm's way. Can you talk about some of the things you consider and how you make those choices?
Well, it's one of the most painful decisions, one way or the other, to stay or to leave. for humanitarian people, for unarmed political people. I mean, when we have peacekeepers there, they can defend themselves. Typically in Baghdad, where what we had there was human rights people, humanitarian relief staff, and political people who were there to help build new Iraq institutions. So we were not able to even defend ourselves. Same in Darfur, in the Congo, and in Somalia, in Algeria, where we have lost colleagues. You know, we're the kind of people who are soft-skinned and high yield for terrorists and other ruthless people, because we were easy to get and we make headlines when we're killed. And that's why it's so important that all governments and all members of the UN help provide protection and condemn this, all of this. Should we stay? Should we leave? It is, in the end, a judgment call based on two things. How high is the risk on the one side? How important is it that we stay in terms of human lives on the other side? In Darfur, I would say millions depend with their life on our presence. In Iraq, the bitter irony was that when we were bombed, we were not given a key role by the invading forces. We had a fairly minor role, and therefore, in the end, the decision was we couldn't do anything in these circumstances. And unfortunately, we withdrew our international staff, which we have now put back.
Jan Egeland is my guest. He's former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. His new book is called A Billion Lives, an Eyewitness Report from the Front Lines of Humanity. We will return to our conversation with Jan after this break. You can get on the line now to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jan Egeland. He is former United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. He'll be in town Wednesday to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. He joins us this afternoon from the studios of WRTI at Temple University in Philadelphia. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. Jan, what sort of pressure do you find is most effective in getting countries that can afford it to support international relief? Is it domestic pressure? Is it international pressure?
Well, I think the most effective pressure is actually inspiration. We have to get the message across that we are able to save a lot of lives very effectively, very efficiently. We can save a child's life with $2 a day for food, $1 a day for school, $1 a day for vaccination. It is truly very effective and efficient what the UN and what the non-governmental organizations, the charity groups, the solidarity groups are doing. In the tsunami, one of the reasons that we raised $13 billion from 90 countries, from many, many millions of individuals and corporations, was that we could explain, as I did in twice a day international press conferences, that we reached the people, we saved lives, we could prevent disease, we could rebuild. Our problem is very often that we're not able to get the message across that we're succeeding.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nagatu in Dallas. Hi, Nagatu.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, just the world is running out of natural resource, especially in the third world. On the contrary, we are doing nothing to reverse it. I was in Africa 11 years ago after I lived 13 years abroad. The place I born and I grow used to have 50 to 40% covered with forest, but now it has less than 2 or 1%. The next 10 to 15 years, most of African countries will not be able to feed themselves, and they become more dependent on the outside help. And how long we can sustain this, and we get more and more people are depending on outside help. Can we create or reverse to save these countries so they can help themselves? That's my one comment. The second thing is the Chinese, they are notoriously very bad for human rights, and unfortunately they become superpower and they are buying African natural resources. Therefore, thousands of people are dying, and they don't do nothing, and they don't care about it. And it has been 2 years or 3 years talking. We are not doing anything. The international body is doing nothing. Can we do anything to get a result? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I mean, there were several questions. Number one, can we reverse the environmental degradation in Africa? And yes, indeed, we can reverse it. Many places it has even been reversed. But certainly, as the caller said, there are places in Africa now where the forest is erased permanently. And there are places where they just go in and they loot the mineral resources. That was the case of the Congo, an extremely resource-rich nation. It was looted and plundered through this civil war. What can be done? I think three things. Number one, the elites of Africa has to provide more good governance. I mean, they have to root out the rampant corruption, the favoritism, and basically plan, like we've done in my country, Norway, with the oil resources, plan how to use it over generations for future generations growing up. Secondly, those investing, including Asian economic superpowers, have to be more socially aware of the consequences of their investments. It is not true that China is unaware of the economic consequences. China is actually now investing more in infrastructure and vital roads and railroads and so on than any European or North American country. However, I don't think they have the same standards for their companies as has become the standard in the West in terms of corporate social responsibility. And thirdly, we have to invest more in disaster prevention in Africa, making people more resilient to natural hazards, to the natural disasters, and also helping people to replant with the wet forests, to have possibilities of irrigation system where the desert is increasing and coming up, help them to go from old ways which do not work anymore in a growing population to new ways with new technology. Yes, it can be reversed, and I think then I also mentioned on the second large issue that indeed we have to have more countries aware of how they can indeed influence the parties to conflicts in Africa to reach out, to make peace deals, and not continue abuse, war, as it's happening in today in Darfur.
How does the UN make decisions when it comes to allocating resources between immediate relief efforts and projects that are designed to provide better conditions in the long term?
Well, of course, the UN is getting its funding from member states. The UN can not print money. Member states print money, and they then invest through the UN. For some of the activities, like peacekeeping operation, there is an assessed scale. So the United States pays 22%, Japan pays 19%, nearly as much. And then there is actually a drop to the next ones, I think being Germany and the like. And then there are voluntary contributions where, you know, my own country, Norway, is by far the biggest in relative terms, or one of the three, four biggest in the world in terms of voluntary contribution. And that's for humanitarian work and so on. And then it's up really to the countries to say, do we want to give, which is emergency aid, where the United States is very big and very generous, or do we want to invest in development work, like through the Food and Agriculture Organization, making the countries improve their own agriculture longer time, where it's more the Europeans which are the biggest investors.
You alluded to this briefly earlier, Jan, but your interest in public service and in human rights began when you were a teenager and you moved to Colombia and did some on-the-ground work there. Can you talk about the environment you grew up in and how that contributed to your interest in serving other people?
Yeah, well, I grew up in southwestern Norway in a shielded, happy, middle-class environment. But I was told by my parents that I shouldn't take anything of this for granted. They themselves had grown up in Nazi-occupied Norway. They had seen, the extreme poverty of the 1930s. My grandparents were wartime sailors. My grandfather was torpedoed twice by Nazi U-boats. I mean, it was not. It's not. One shouldn't take for granted that my whole upbringing, if you like. And then I was a Lutheran family, social democratic in political leaning. I decided to go to Latin America to see for myself what I consider the biggest social drama of our time, which was basically fighting for social justice in the most unjust societies of our time, which I thought were Latin America. So I, with friends, we landed in Canada, took the Greyhound to Chicago, bought an American station wagon for $1,200, and then we drove from Chicago to Panama, including driving through Highway 10, isn't it, west through Texas.
I-10, sure.
And we came, and this was 1976, so I've seen the Alamo, and I've seen Texas, and then we drove through Central America, Mexico, Central America, all the way down to the road ending in Panama. And then I went on myself in plane to Colombia, where I had an invitation from a Catholic relief organization. And I worked with an Indian tribe in the jungles who were still hunting with bow and arrow. I worked with peasant cooperatives in the mountains where the guerrilla was fighting, and it was the eye-opener for my life, and I was hooked for life. You know, I wanted to really work for social justice, for human rights, for peace, and I have been privileged to be able to do that the rest of my life.
Have you ever looked at your commitment to these things as a sort of personal sacrifice? In other words, you do this because you believe in it, but you recognize that there are other options that you traded away in choosing to do this with your life.
No, I see myself as extremely privileged. And it's not because you're expected to say that, because it's true. if you're allowed to work with what is the most important thing for you, for humankind, and they even pay you money for doing that, and they treat you well doing that, you're very, very lucky. And in many ways, I've been more lucky than the people who watch on the television and look at these images of suffering and so on and feel, you know, it's hopeless. I've seen that we succeeded much more often than we failed. We were able to make peace more often than we failed. We were able to reach out and save hundreds of thousands of lives, even in the most desperate of circumstances. I think the main, perhaps only sacrifice has been that I've seen my own children too little. I traveled for 200 days in this UN job. I was I had to be all over where these wars and disaster zones were exploding to coordinate and lead the efforts.
You've been on the ground in so many really terrible places that are experiencing great tragedies. You have talked to people on both sides, including those who are committing the violence. I'm wondering if it's harder for you to understand apathy to these situations than it is to understand how people who are committing atrocities get to the place where they feel like this is the only way they can maintain control.
Well, it's very hard to understand either side. No, apathy, I've never understood really, because I would consider it intensely humane for anybody to say, let's do what we can do. Let's do what it is possible to do. If you can help, you must help. It is a privilege and an obligation to help. But of course, it's impossible to apprehend what these warlords and guerrilla leaders and generals and dictators are doing. At times, you of course understand that they are locked in a vicious cycle of violence. Revenge is their motive, or defense. I mean, many of them feel that they are not the aggressors. They feel they are defending their life of their men themselves. You will remember that Saturday 1 week ago, there was 1.5 weeks ago now, there was an incursion of Colombia into Ecuador, which brought this new crisis between Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela. And who was killed there? Well, one of the interlocutors in the peace process that I coordinated in Colombia, and a man I brought to Norway. So it's very dramatic to see how these people are killed for the lack of making a compromise.
Jan Egeland will be in town Wednesday. You can find more about his appearance at dfwworld.org. Jan, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.